You're listening to an extended show of Courts in Session. I'm your rocking attorney, Eric Jackson Lurie. This, of course, is WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. We're celebrating the legacy of the great Rick Derringer. Rick recorded one of the best Christian rock albums, in my opinion, of all time. It came out in 2014. You're hearing the track One Way to the Lord from the album High Times, High City. And highly recommended. If you're digging this, you'll dig the whole album. Well, we're going to close the show now. Final song by request, so apropos. This is Rick Derringer. Don't ever say goodbye. Good night, Pittsburgh.
We'll be right back. Lordy Mama! I can tell you guys are with us tonight. Lordy Mama! Lordy Mama! Lordy Mama! Lordy Mama! Lordy Mama! Lordy Mama! Lordy Mama.
You got me so I can't sleep. Thank you. People say our country is facing polarization like never before. At Inform Your Community, we're on a mission to change that narrative. We believe that even in disagreement, we can find common ground and work towards solutions with respect. At Inform Your Community, we know the best way to talk about difficult topics is to talk about difficult topics. We're here to educate, bridge gaps, and encourage dialogue by providing engaging, welcoming, and meaningful events that discuss the timely civic issues that matter to you most. At informyourcommunity.org, we foster an environment of civility and respect. Here, we value productive dialogue over hostility and strive for understanding. To learn more about a movement that believes in the power of respectful discourse to heal our communities and address crucial issues that you care about, please visit informyourcommunity.org. We have a motto at Inform Your Community: civility, not hostility.
Turn of a mile, my curiosity running wild, cruising and playing the radio with no particular place to go, riding along in my
WRCT Pittsburgh, music for people on the go.
I sent you to tell her the way I feel. So I told her softly and sincere, and she leaned and whispered in my ear.
Think about your mother, your sister, your girlfriend. One in six women is a victim of sexual assault. Now think about your father, your brother, your best friend. Men are victims too. Rape can happen to anyone. This is Christina Ricci with RAIN, encouraging you to call the National Sexual Assault Hotline to learn how to support someone you love. Call 1-800-656-HOPE or visit rain.org. That's RAIN.org.
Brought to you by RAIN and this state.
You are listening to Ebony Spectrum and In Black America here on WRCT Pittsburgh and at WRCT.org.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
Players have been embracing me, like when we had USA basketball here in Las Vegas, 60 games. All of the players on that team, Blake Griffin, all of the young guys coming up and giving me hugs and kisses and thanking me. Because, you know, in their situation, just in terms of dollars and cents, from LeBron James, he's got an extra $100 million. Kobe got an extra $100 million. Blake Griffin got an extra $50 million. Kevin Durant will give me a big hug because he's got $75 million extra. So that's the numbers and dollars and cents that I give you an example of what it is. Because with 4 years, if you have to wait 4 years after your high school class to graduate, you would lose that kind of capital. And you will lose that playing time. You will lose your scoring titles. You will lose your numbers that will help them get into the hall later on. Those numbers will be erased. And you don't know what's going to happen in 4 years in college.
Spencer Haywood, ABA, NBA legend, and Hall of Famer. Haywood will always be remembered as the person who opened the door for underclassmen college basketball players to leave college early to enter the NBA, thereby creating the Spencer Haywood Rule. Haywood attended the University of Detroit and helped the U.S. Olympic team to a gold medal at the 1968 Summer Games in Mexico City. In 1968, after 2 years in college, he decided to enter the NBA draft, citing family financial hardship. The NBA, however, at the time, prohibited players from entering the draft until 4 years after their high school graduation. Haywood then signed with the ABA's Denver Rockets, where he played one season, leading the league in scoring and rebounding as a rookie. Since he now had a professional season under his belt, he decided to challenge the NBA rule once again and signed with the Seattle Supersonics in 1969. The NBA wasn't having it. Haywood challenged the league all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court and won. On September 11, 2015, he was enshrined into the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame. I'm Johnny L. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, ABA and NBA legend and Hall of Famer Spencer Haywood in Black America.
Charles Barkley went out on the limb when this stuff was acting, when they were acting crazy, and they missed me like the last time of going into the Hall of Fame. I was like put on the back burner.
Right.
Charles Barkley stepped up and said, enough is enough. And he did it publicly. He did it every way possible. He said, enough is enough. Now, this is not right. And he stood up as a player, and he started educating the young players. Like, do y'all know who is in our presence with Spencer Haywood, blah, blah, blah? And he started talking about, you know, there's like three cases that changed the face of sports. And one is Spencer Haywood, Haywood versus the NBA. That case went to the Supreme Court. And then players, young players started like, whoa, wait a minute. I know him. I see him. But I never knew that. And so Charles was the one that should be there. And he's my, what you call, my advocate. And my advocate is just a good person, just a wonderful person.
Spencer Haywood won an Olympic gold medal in 1968 at the age of 19 and signed with the Seattle Supersonics 2 years later after dominating the ABA. In a case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court, he sued the NBA over a rule that prohibited players from being drafted into the league until they had waited 4 years after graduating from high school. He won that case. In 1980, he won a world championship with the Los Angeles Lakers. As a 20-year-old rookie in the 1969-70 season, he led the American Basketball Association in both scoring and rebounding and was named the league's most valuable player and rookie of the year. Born on April 27, 1949 in Silver City, Mississippi, into a family of 10 children, Haywood grew up in a dying era of American history. His mother picked cotton for $2 a day, and Haywood joined her in the field at the age of 5. In 1964, he moved to Chicago, then to Detroit. In the Motor City, he led Pershing High School to the 1967 Michigan Class A State Basketball Championship. He went on to stellar careers at Trinidad State Junior College and the University of Detroit. In the summer of 1968, he helped the United States to a gold medal at the Olympic Games in Mexico City. On September 11, 2015, Haywood was inducted into the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame.
My first reaction was, you know, is this a fact and is this true? Because I had had three false alarms before that, because most reporters and most people who look at numbers, and they look at my numbers as a player, and that this guy was MVP of the ABA, averaging 30 and 25 years with the Seattle Supersonics, averaging 26 and 13, and he's an Olympic record holder in all of these different categories, and as still as the leading scorer, and also was the outstanding college player of the year. So they look at all of these things, and they just assumed that I was all, everybody thought I was in. Then, you know, also I went to the Supreme Court to fight Haywood versus the NBA to pave the way for the LeBrons, Michael Jordan, Magic, all of them. They come through what is called Haywood versus the NBA. They call it early entry. Mm-hmm. And now I think it should be just called what it is, the Spencer Haywood rule, because they have the Larry Bird rule and they have Oscar Robertson rule, regrettably so with Oscar. But I know they promote Larry Bird's rule, and Larry Bird's rule is the modified version of my rule. But Larry Bird came in under the Spencer Haywood rule. But anyway, so for years we thought it would happen, and then there was a couple of false alarms that it did happen. So I was kidding around with John DeLiva, who is the chairman and CEO of the hall, and he was mentioning, you know, well, I told you, Spencer, the cream rises always to the top. And I said, well, what has that got to do with Kareem? Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, my bland joke, John.
Right.
So it was delighted, man, to get the call and to finally get the call, to finally get it in. But, you know, my mother used to sing this old song, The Lord may not come when you want him, but he's right on time. And that's Mahalia Jackson.
Right.
And so, you know, if it had happened any other time, I think it would have been not as powerful as it is today.
Mm-hmm.
And it was right on time, and it's on God's time. So I'm very grateful and very humbled by the whole journey.
I understand. So once you heard that you were going to be inducted, walk us through that period from the time that you got the call to the induction ceremony that took place last Friday, September the 11th. What all the activities have you been involved with?
Well, I've been all over the country speaking, and people wanting to know this story because it's a unique story, and it is basketball history, but yet, you know, it hadn't been told. So it's a newfound appreciation for Spencer Haywood. So players have been embracing me, like when we had USA Basketball here in Las Vegas, the games, all of the players on that team, Blake Griffin, all of the young guys coming up and giving me hugs and kisses and thanking me because, you know, in their situation, just in terms of dollars and cents, so LeBron James, he's got an extra $100 million. Kobe got an extra $100 million. Blake Griffin got an extra $50 million. Kevin Durant, who gave me a big hug and a kiss, he's got $75 million extra. So that's the numbers and dollars and cents that I give you an example of what it is. Because with 4 years, if you had to wait 4 years after your high school class had graduated, you would lose that kind of capital.
Right.
And you would lose that playing time. You would lose your scoring titles. You would lose your numbers that will help them get into the hall later on. Those numbers would be erased. And you don't know what's going to happen in 4 years in college. You could get hurt. A lot of things could happen. So they are fully appreciating me. It's a good feeling because it took 44 years or more for this to happen. So it is right on time, on God's time. So and then I went to I've been doing a lot of golf tournaments for charitable events and also just playing a lot. And I spent a lot of time with my family, my daughters. And in fact, I got to leave again next week. My next two oldest daughters having our first grandchild.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to go through the process with her. And it is a spectacular time. And I often sit back, John, and think about the times we were sitting in your dad's barbershop there on Sunset and just on Nevada, and just Nevada and Detroit, for people who don't know,
right.
And Detroit, Michigan. And John's father's where we used to congregate and do our conversation and get a nice haircut because he didn't allow us to walk around with our hair all falling over our ears and stuff. So
no, that's right.
Yeah, you know that's right. So we would sit there and listen and talk and just talk basketball, sports, football and stuff. So I've been reflecting on Detroit. I went over to my neighborhood yesterday,
mm-hmm.
day before yesterday, and spent some time over there at Pershing, looking around, and just tearing up because, Don, you know the story. You know when I came up from Mississippi,
right.
I had no place to stay. I had no family there, and James and Ida Bell took me in and adopted me along with my coach, Will Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had Wayne Dyer, Dr. Wayne Dyer, your erroneous zone, Wayne Dyer.
Right.
Do all of my academics, bring me up to snuff there. Oh, my God, it was just a lot of love was happening in our city in Detroit. And it's always been that way. You know, they've always reached out and helped each other.
No, that's right. Why did you select the three individuals that you had at the podium with you for your induction ceremonies?
Well, Lenny Wilkins was my player. He was my point guard on the Seattle Supersonics when I went to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
He was my coach and he was my advisor. He took me through that whole process. Because I had just turned 20, man. I just turned 21. And to go through all of that, I needed someone like him. And he was a champion. And then Bill Walton and I, we became very good friends because we were up in Seattle and Portland. And so we were like the outpost of the NBA. So we leaned on each other. We spent time with each other. We did a lot of good things. And as I mentioned to the audience, he's a deadhead, which means he's a grateful deadhead. And I'm a jazz head. So that's pretty cool stuff there. And Charles Barkley went out on the limb when this stuff was acting, when they were acting crazy. And they missed me like the last time of going into the Hall of Fame. I was like put on the back burner.
Right.
Charles Barkley stepped up and said, enough is enough. And he did it publicly. He did it every way possible. He said, enough is enough. Now, this is not right. And he stood up as a player and he started educating the young players. Like, do y'all know who is in our presence with Spencer Haywood, blah, blah, blah? And he started talking about, you know, there's like three cases that changed the face of sports. And one is Spencer Haywood, Haywood versus the NBA. That case went to the Supreme Court. And then players, young players started like, whoa, wait a minute. I know him. I see him. Mm-hmm. But I never knew that. And so Charles was the one that should be there. And he's my, what you call, my advocate. And my advocate is a good person, just a wonderful person. And it's a rare thing to see a Mississippi boy and an Alabama boy standing on the stage together.
You're listening to In Black America with Johnny O. Hanson, Jr. We'll be back in just a moment.
Support comes from Austin Water. Residents and businesses can take steps now to prepare for the possibility of severe and freezing temperatures by having emergency supplies like water and insulation for pipes. More winter preparedness tips at austinwater.org.
And now back to this episode of In Black America.
Welcoming Spencer to the Hall of Fame are Charles Barkley, Lenny Wilkins, and Bill Walton. Ladies and gentlemen, Spencer Haywood.
Thank you so much, and thank you all for letting me join this great fraternity. Standing on my right here, my friend who walked me through the journey when I was 21 years old, Lenny Wilkins, walked me through it. A dear friend and a great competitor and a champion. My friend, Bill Walton. Hold on one second, y'all. He's a deadhead, and I'm a jazz head. Okay? For the Grateful Dead. Yes, sir. And my man, Charles Barkley. Oh, my gosh, what a fierce competitor. Great human being. And it's probably only twice that you'll see a guy from Alabama and Mississippi standing on the stage together, but we'll do this tonight. But I thank you for being my guardian angel to educate the young men that play this game today about my life and who I am and what I've done for the game. Thank you so much, and God bless you. Thank you. My life, my career started in Silver City, Mississippi, population 300. And my mom and my nine siblings, we picked cotton for 12 hours a day in the cotton fields in the Delta of Mississippi. We didn't have money and food, but we sure did have a love for God. We had a special relationship with God. And many times we would be so hungry and we would be so desperate. But every time God came through for our family, somebody would walk up to us and say, Eunice, I got some beans. I got some rice. And we were able to eat. And so from that humble beginning, my brother Leroy, he's right here, and he said, man, you know what? I want to come and get you and bring you up north to meet a great coach, a man by the name of Will Robinson. Will Robinson was the first black coach to ever coach in NCAA history. Will Robinson. Robinson adopt me and raise me, along with James and Ida Bell. These people did not know about, you know, this guy was going to be a great talent or a great basketball player. It was a human spirit. They just grabbed me, and I know the hand of God was in charge of all of it. I know it. And because, I mean, I just want to think about it. And from there, we were able to win the Class A state championship, the first time the city of Detroit had ever won it in 35 years. And along the way, a young man from the Detroit Pistons, who had no business playing with high school boys like us, Ralph Simpson, myself, Dave Bing, right there. Dave Bing. Dave Bing would bring the Pistons over to our gym in high school, and we scrimmaged the Pistons. That's the kind of love that we had going on in Detroit. It was a special and wonderful love. From there, I decided to go back home and go down south. I signed with the University of Tennessee. It did not work out, so I ended up in Trinidad, Colorado. And Will Robinson said to me, well, you know, this place is close to Denver, and it's also close to Albuquerque. I didn't know because we didn't have Google. We didn't have anything. So I said, yeah, let's go. So I go to Trinidad and become the Junior College Player of the Year. In 1968, we had a black boycott of the 68 Olympics. And a number of great players stood with the solidarity of the African-American community and said, I'm not going. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Wesley Unseld, Elvin Hayes. And the coach said, I got a kid down here in junior college. Hank Iver said, I got a boy down there in junior college. He's only 18. We're going to bring him down here to the U.S. Olympics in Mexico City. And they brought me down there, and I was like, wow. And again, we were an underdog in 1968. We was not supposed to win, but we went 9-0, and we won the gold medal. I set a record in points with 144. This guy that just came in 2012 broke it after 44 years. Kevin Durant. Is he here? No, I'm just joking. But anyway, so I was like, wow. And I set a field goal percentage record at 72, and I became the youngest American in the history of America to win a gold medal at age 19 years old. And from there, I went back to the University of Detroit, where I was the College Player of the Year, Outstanding College Player of the Year. I was doing pretty good numbers. I was doing 32 and 23. Yeah, I know. 32 points, 23 boards. And so the NBA had made a big draft pick for Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And the ABA came to me calling and like knocking on the door. You're going to need help. Your family's poor. Come on, let's come with me. And so I signed with them because I was disappointed that the University of Detroit did not sign Will Robinson as my coach, which we agreed upon. But it worked out for the better. So here I am in Denver. That first year in Denver, I averaged 30 points and 20 rebounds for 82 games. So I was doing serious work. Serious work. I became the MVP, Rookie of the Year, leading scorer, leading rebounder, MVP of the All-Star Game. There's only two players in the history of basketball to ever do that, and the great Wilt Chamberlain, God rest his soul, is one or the other. But then I signed with Seattle, and I was still an underclassman, but I had a guardian angel in Seattle, just like Barkley is my today's guardian angel.
If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio, and we're speaking with Spencer Haywood, Michigan high school basketball champion, Olympic gold medalist, ABA MVP and Rookie of the Year, NBA All-Star and champion, and now an inductee into the NBA Hall of Fame. Spencer, doing a little bit of research.
And John, I have made more black men millionaires than anyone in the history of America. Remember that.
Now, I know that's right. In doing some of the research, I understand that Jesse Owens spoke to you all during before the 1968 Olympics about some of you all maybe considering boycotting. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, okay. Let me just bring your audience up to date. You know, in 1968, we had the black boycott called by Harry Edwards, and some players did boycott. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Wesley Unseld, Elvin Hayes, Bob Lanier.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then when we got to the tryouts, there were guys who were cut, just Pete Maravich, Calvin Murphy, and Rick Mount. These guys were cut from the team. And so we went in along and doing our best. And then we had a big meeting where they brought in George Foreman, myself, Tommy Smith, John Carlos, and all of us. And he brought us into a room, and we had a guest speaker. And Tommy and John was under a lot of pressure because Harry Edwards was their professor at San Jose State. So
mm-hmm.
those guys were under a little bit of a more pressure than we were. And so they brought Jesse Owens to speak to us. And Jesse was talking, you know, the importance of, you know, oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light, you know, the flag and all of that stuff,
mm-hmm.
and why it's important. And we were like, you know, like John, you know, young guys are sitting there like, yeah. This is 60s, you know, late 60s. And yeah. And he just got angry, and he turned at all of us and looked at us and pointed a finger at all of us. How would any of you SOBs felt trying to win a gold medal in the front of Hitler? And everybody was like, oh, he did not go there, did he? And so we started lacing them up and saying, oh, we're on track to do this. And so Tommy and John says, well, you know, I want to do a little something to show solidarity to the black folks back home that we are with you. We just wanted to do something for America and for our people. And so they put on the glove and they, you know, did the salute. And then they escorted them out of the Olympic Village and ostracized them for years. And so Jesse was pretty serious, dude. He was a serious man. Mm-hmm. I loved his speech.
I understand.
They almost scared me. But, yeah, I had Will Robinson there, too, you know.
You've mentioned during your acceptance speech that you're going to cut your remarks short. What did you leave out?
I left out my two daughters. I left out Isis, who was on a photo shoot. She's a buddy and model. So
mm-hmm.
You know how those people are. They're wishy-washy anyway. No, I'm just joking. And then my next to oldest daughter is having a baby and having our first grandchild, and it's a boy. And our first male in my home, because I have four daughters and a mm-hmm. wife, so all I am is a yes man. So maybe this time I'll have somebody to
got your back, huh?
Stand with me tall a little bit. At least kick up the toilet stool and, you know, kick up the toilet seat and say, yeah, I stand tall, son.
How has their reaction?
I missed that part. I missed okay. Wayne Dyer's part.
Mm-hmm.
I missed some things, but I, you know, all in all, I got everything. I, you know, John, look, when I did that speech, I had that speech on the teleprompter in front of me. I had the notes in front of me. I had all of my speech written out in front of me. I was supposed to go page for page. I got up there, and I had been praying on it.
Mm-hmm.
God, speak through me tonight. Let me carry out your will and not my own. And I got up there. And I scratched everything, just shut it down, and just spoke from my heart what I felt. And I carried it all off, and I got everybody in. It was a really good speech, you know, but it wasn't something I planned or something that happened. It was the Lord speaking through me. And I don't want people to think, you know, he's one of those holy endowed. He don't, you know, mm-hmm. Some people are, they get so holy, they're against gay rights, they're against, you know, everything. And I'm not that guy. I'm just saying from a spiritual standpoint,
mm-hmm.
that's what happened to me.
Throughout your basketball life and your personal life, you've been a champion on the court and off the court. How do you put all that in perspective?
Well, I put it in perspective because right now we are in, we are like halfway through finishing up the Spencer Haywood story, the documentary. We have the script finished with the movie, and those things are coming really, really strongly now. And I got some really strong people behind me. I got the Oprah Winfrey gentleman that put together our own TV and our own network. It's one of my biggest sponsors on my movie project, and we got some really, really, really serious people. I'm waiting for Denzel to call me because I think that this story lends itself to his directing.
Spencer Haywood, NBA Hall of Famer. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You can hear previous programs online at KUT.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
Next up, we have some of our regular features here on Ebony Spectrum. And first is Lene Vinay, and followed up by Other Folks.
Hey y'all, what's up? It's Friday, so I'm gonna keep it black, but I'm gonna keep it brief. These people are not my... Now that that's settled, there's a lot to recap and recount that I won't. If you expect me to have some sort of master plan, I don't. But just because they are up there carrying on Project 2025 as we told you they would, raining down oppressive statute after oppressive statute, strategy is not lost on us. I told y'all a long time ago, danger is real, but fear is not. And I'm going to encourage you not to let fear distract you in this moment. The seemingly relentless, very fast shift in power is designed to present a brute show of force with a menacingly imperious and impervious level of propaganda. And that's great, actually. That means we know what time it is. We feel what we do not understand, right? So never forget that you actually understand exactly what's going on here, so just do not engage. Fear-mongering and rage-baiting will become routine, online and in person. So if there was ever a time to shut our asses up, it's now. Now, I'm not telling you to allow yourself to be silenced or intimidated into submission. I'm telling you to sit back, learn, and move in silence. My granddaddy used to say, you let somebody talk long enough, they'll tell you everything you need to know. But we need not show our hand. Now, that's not to say we can go on living our daily lives unaffected by this tragic upheaval. Because 92% is all you want, this is not just going to affect the brown people and the gays, as if brown and gay was mutually exclusive from black. But even if it was, as a 92% of myself, let me tell you what would apply to you regardless. These anti-immigration laws, hate to tell you and I hope I don't sound ridiculous, but they don't just concern the people you see cleaning up your hallways or doing construction work on the side of the road. This man is also trying to undo birthright citizenship, which was a part of the 14th Amendment, established so that African Americans could be recognized as full citizens. And if he were to put a stop to that after February 19th, that would mean an end to the whole first generation born American deal that's become part of the fabric of so many Nigerian, Jamaican, Haitian, and other black family dynamics across the diaspora. He's gunning for your insulin. And these days, that doesn't just mean grandma's insulin, because next to American Indians and Alaskan Natives, non-Hispanic black adults have the second highest prevalence of diagnosed diabetes in the United States. So while he hasn't removed the $35 cap yet, because that's a law and there has to be a process, don't forget that not only did he win the presidency, but the House and Senate have a Republican majority as well. In his efforts to forge a society that is colorblind and merit-based, he sounded off in his first state with an order to end radical and wasteful government DEI programs and preferencing to eradicate all DEI programs, departments, and budgets federally. And then there's the executive order to reverse Lyndon B. Johnson's executive order from 1965. Now, what he might not know is that the Equal Employment Opportunity Act itself cannot be revoked because it, too, is a law that was enacted by a former president. But these people are already trying to supersede states' rights, so who knows what could happen down the road. Now, most of these these things will affect federal workers first, because that's all he legally has control of. They already sent the emails telling people they got 10 days to suss out DEI contractors and report them, because according to his administration, we already got the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and anything else on top of that is unconstitutional and just reverse racism. These people are constantly twisting and misrepresenting factual information, not just to reach their own political aims or to cover up America's misgivings, but to also perpetuate the longstanding idea that black people cannot handle freedom, that we have either mismanaged it, taken advantage of it, or that in our hands is simply dangerous. And to that I say, you're right, because the freedom that you speak of, the only kind of freedom that has ever been awarded to us, has only ever been a version of it, an abbreviation, a quasi-freedom meted by whatever measure of privilege is deemed expendable at the time. Because at every opportunity for progress, whiteness does not hold itself accountable for its wrongdoing. Instead, it inflates itself by taking credit for the progress that was made in spite of it, because it for damn sure wasn't made on behalf of it. And then it says, well, how much privilege am I willing to give this time? Because I still got to maintain order, and somehow they always still want more. You damn Skippy. So they get chaotic when we start to make our dollar out of 15 cents. They start scrambling when we turn the world upside down with our 15 minutes of fame. And if you haven't noticed, it's not just a battle between white and black, between good and evil, but a game of call and response. And it's what we do with our taste of freedom that never fails to send them into a frenzy. And I don't know how many people of faith we got in the audience today, but one thing about my God is he does his best work in times of chaos. Hey! Woo! Because yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of what? Hey! Oh, he prepares a table before me when? In the presence of who? Oh, okay. But alas, faith without works is dead. And in the face of all this, it's time for you to tap into community. That means to engage in community relief efforts. Educate yourself on community resources. Be more open to the people who look like you, and let go of the individualism that is set up to leave us weak and vulnerable. And while you're at it, shut up about it. Why? Because the revolution will not be televised, and it won't be on social media either. So, Elon Musk done got hold of the federal budget. And before I get to explaining anything else, I just want to say this is precisely why Brenda from A Scary Movie, a.k.a. Regina Hall, was hollering in that movie theater like that. Talking about, whoa,